With nearly 15 million people out of work last month, according to the latest government unemployment report, that's a lot of people competing for a limited number of jobs. Some are turning to a new generation of job search websites that claim to play matchmaker. And as NPR's Tamara Keith found, it may not be love at first sight.
Mike Lynn Bauman has been actively job hunting for about a year, and in that time, she's applied for a lot of jobs.
Oh, I would say at least 100 jobs here and there for my experience and then below my experience, too, just trying to find something. It's a tough market.
And applying for all those jobs has been a bit like throwing resumes into a black hole with very few nibbles or even automated responses. She'd like to find a marketing job at a medical devices company near her home in Orange County, California. That's what Bauman was doing before she took off a couple of years to raise her kids. But now her husband is out of work, too, and the job search is getting urgent. Every day, she visits four or five job sites like Monster.com and CareerBuilder.
It's pretty much the same. You see the same jobs posted everywhere.
Along with a few legit prospects, Bauman says these sites are full of offers for degrees from mail-order universities and sales opportunities with Avon.
You start getting exhausted just filtering through the junk.
For the last month or so, her daily job search has included a visit to one of the newer job matching sites. It's called JobFox.
I like this site a lot. I think it's really clean, which is a positive.
Though she says she'd like it even more if it led to a job or even an interview. The founder of JobFox is Rob McGovern.
We're kind of like eHarmony, but for jobs.
McGovern started CareerBuilder back in the 90s. He says job search algorithms have come a long way since then.
You know, when the first search engines came along, you had to be a search expert. You had to do this thing called Boolean search to put search terms in and really ferret out the data. And then along came Google and said, no, we're going to build a smarter search engine. Well, the same thing's happening in jobs.
Rather than just posting a resume, JobFox users fill out detailed profiles that get very specific about their skills and hopes for a new position. Then McGovern says candidates are matched up with job postings that are just right.
When you look at 10 jobs on our surface, we want you to say, wow, all 10 of those, I'd be good for that. And we want the employer that sees you to say, this person's really qualified, as opposed to the, oh, here's yet another resume I didn't want.
Mark Chabatari has applied for about 20 tech industry positions through JobFox, but so far those leads haven't resulted in any job interviews.
Is it that much better or differentiated than what Monster and some of the other sites are doing? It is different. When someone has said, hey, I saw your credentials on JobFox, let's talk, then you'll have a convinced winner.
There are a handful of sites out there now that promise more targeted job searching, with names like Indeed, The Ladders, and Quiet Agent. Monster is getting in on the matchmaking, too, with a new power search that's still in beta mode. But they all face one big obstacle, the job market itself. Tamara Keith, NPR News, Washington.
Next, we have a reminder that changes in the American economy can affect the rest of the world. Mexicans working abroad sent home less money last year than the year before, about 16% less. That is the largest annual decline in remittances ever recorded by Mexico's central bank, which is important because Mexico depends heavily on those cash transfers. They're the country's second largest source of income after oil exports, and they come mostly from Mexicans working in the United States. NPR's Jason Beaubien recently visited the central Mexican state of Hidalgo, where in some villages almost half the residents live and work north of the border.
The village of El Alberto is tucked into rugged, cactus-covered hills in Hidalgo, miles from the nearest city. El Alberto jumps out of the dry landscape like a strange experiment. Big American-looking homes that could have been erected in subdivisions outside St. Louis or Atlanta sit next to cinder block shacks. But when you look closer, many of the big houses aren't finished. Some are just shells. Some are abandoned construction sites. These houses represent the dreams of Mexican migrants, many of which currently are on hold. Federico Ramon looks after two unfinished properties that were started by his brothers. They're in this state because there isn't the money to finish them, he says. And there are other half-finished projects all around him. People leave their houses to try to make money and sustain their families, Ramon says. Here, there's nothing but some beans, squash, and cornfields. There's no way to make a living. Ramon's two brothers and his 18-year-old son are all in Las Vegas, but he says they haven't been getting much work lately. Across the ravine from Ramon is a concrete shell of a split-level ranch house. Just up the dirt road is a massive project with a drive-in garage, tinted windows, and colonnades on either side of the entryway. But rusting fingers of rebar poke up from the structure, waiting for a second floor that still hasn't been built. Residents say as the U.S. economy slipped into recession, construction here in El Alberto ground to a halt. Last year, Mexican migrants sent home $21 billion, according to Mexico's central bank, a sharp drop from the peak of $26 billion sent back in 2007.
Mis hijos pues está allá en el otro lado.
Carmen Maqueda San Juan runs a small grocery store in El Alberto. She says all six of her children are on the other side. Of the six, only her daughter still has steady work as a maid. Maqueda says her kids used to send home money, but now she's lucky if she gets a phone call. They say there's no work, she says. Sometimes once a week or for part of a day they work, but that's it. Local officials estimate that more than 90% of the migrants from this part of Hidalgo are in the United States illegally. There's no shame here in crossing the border illicitly to look for work. Israel Pio Quinto Rafael, the head of migrant services for the nearby city of Ixmiquilpan, estimates that 30 to 40% of the local population works in the U.S. Remittances are very important here, Pio Quinto says. It's the base of the economy in this area. And it's not just here in Hidalgo. Cash sent home from migrants has been propping up remote villages throughout the region. In Guatemala, Honduras, and Haiti, they're the leading source of income and the backbone of the national economies. The drop in this source of cash, Pio Quinto says, affects the entire community. People have less money to spend in the markets. Even a local mariachi band says their bookings fell sharply last year as residents have fewer pesos in their pockets.
Pensamos que iba a venir mucha gente de Estados Unidos a México, pero no fue así.
We were expecting that a lot of people were going to come back from the United States to Mexico, Pio Quinto says, but it hasn't really happened. Yes, some came back because at times they didn't have anything to eat, but many have decided to stay and hope that the U.S. economy recovers. He says 10 years ago, people would have returned to Hidalgo and waited out the economic downturn with their families in Mexico. But with the tighter controls along the border, migrant workers don't want to risk returning home and then being stuck on the outside when the U.S. economy does rebound. Jason Beaubien, NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Bloch.
And I'm Michelle Norris. Over the past 2 years, the Federal Reserve has injected more than $1 trillion worth of stimulus into the economy. The goal was to keep the financial system from collapsing after the worst financial crisis since the Depression. Today, Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke gave a more detailed description of how the Fed is going to pull back the stimulus to keep the economy from overheating and causing inflation. NPR's John Itzty joins us to talk about what Mr. Bernanke had to say. And John, I have to say the economy doesn't seem to be in any danger of overheating anytime soon. So why is Ben Bernanke talking about this right now?
You're right, Michelle. The economy right now is about as hot as the Washington weather. But the reason the chairman is outlining this exit strategy is that bond investors and some economists are worried the Fed will wait too long to take its foot off the economic accelerator and will end up growing too fast, and runaway inflation could be the result. Actually, let me go back to an old metaphor. A lot of people say that the Fed's main job is removing the punch bowl just before the economic party warms up. And in this case, the punch bowl is so big because of all the lending that the Fed has done that the economic party could get way out of hand. So the police, or as we said, bond investors who are worried, dressed up like the police, have shown up at the party even before most of the guests arrived. And they're asking the Fed, how are you going to drain this punch bowl safely? And Mr. Bernanke was explaining exactly how he's going to do that today.
So what is he proposing?
Well, Bernanke pointed out that the Fed had really already begun. Remember, during the financial crisis, it created The Fed created special lending programs to help support short-term loans to businesses and to backstop money market funds. Well, today he pointed out that about a year ago, the Fed had lent over $1 trillion for those programs. And last week, that amount was down to $110 billion. And the chairman also said that before too long, that's a quote, before too long, the Fed might begin raising the discount rate. That's the rate it charges on short-term loans to banks. That would reduce the amount of money that banks could lend into the economy. And one new tool the Fed has is the power to pay interest on more than $1 trillion in reserves that U.S. banks keep on deposit at the Fed. And if the Fed raised the rates it's paying to those banks, they might be enticed to leave their reserves at the Fed rather than lending them out to businesses and individuals, and that would keep the economy in check.
John, there's some careful wording in Ben Bernanke's statement. He says that these are things that the Fed plans to do once the economy has recovered. But how will we know when we're actually past this, when the economy has recovered?
That's a good question, because different people have different views. We've had a couple of positive economic reports recently, the unemployment rate down, a rapid growth in the fourth quarter. A lot of people, a lot of economists see that as signs of recovery. But other people aren't going to see a recovery until all those millions of people who lost their jobs are back at work. And that can be that could take a long, long time. Today, Chairman Bernanke suggested the exit process is about to begin, but he also indicated the Fed is not going to slam on the brakes quickly.
Thank you, John.
You're welcome.
That's NPR's John Yudsty. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Alyssa Block. In 2 weeks, assuming it ever stops snowing here in Washington, President Obama will convene his bipartisan summit on health care. Republican leaders in the House want the current health care overhaul bills scrapped, and they want the discussion to start over. The president said yesterday he's willing to start from scratch in the sense that he'll be open to new ideas, but he does not want what he calls another year of partisan wrangling. We're going to hear now from a Republican member of the House who's put forth a sweeping proposal for fiscal overhaul on everything from Social Security to the tax code, Medicaid, and Medicare. He is Paul Ryan of Wisconsin, ranking member of the House Budget Committee. I asked Congressman Ryan if he agrees with Republican leaders that the health care debate needs to be reset.
The premise of the bill, sort of the policy architecture of the bill, in my opinion, is something that ought to be scrapped, and we ought to start all over from scratch. If you really want bipartisanship, then you got to have collaboration from the beginning. That never occurred last year. So if you do want bipartisanship, that means the party in power has to be willing to collaborate with a minority party. We have yet to see that to this moment. And hopefully we could see that if we start over and put our heads together and come up with a good plan.
Congressman Ryan, when you think about health care costs stretching over time, what's your vision of the sort of fiscal apocalypse that's looming?
Well, and it is a health care problem. And that's where the president, his budget director, Peter Orszag, and I agree with one another, which is our debt crisis and our budget crisis is really a healthcare cost crisis, because our healthcare programs, namely Medicare and Medicaid, are the primary sources and reasons why the federal government goes bankrupt. And that's why we got to address this now, sooner the better. The way I would do it and the way I propose to do it is, look, people who are currently on these programs, you shouldn't pull the rug out from under them. If you're 55 and above, meaning in or near retirement, you're going to get the Medicare program you've got right now, and it's not going to be changed. Right now, it's going bankrupt in just a handful of years. So let's preserve that, and then let's make changes in the future for future generations so that it's more sustainable. And the way I propose doing that, in a nutshell, it's basically have Medicare replicate the exact same health care plan I've got in Congress. I get a payment from the federal government. I get a book from the federal government with a list of health care plans that are pre-certified, and I select the one that's best for my family and myself, and I apply my payment to that.
The basic idea here is you'd be giving seniors money to buy health insurance in the private sector. Some people call this turning Medicare into essentially a voucher program. The Congressional Budget Office ran the numbers on your plan, and they concluded that beneficiaries would face higher premiums in the private market. They'd end up with less comprehensive health plans, fewer services. In other words, the money that seniors would be getting would not be keeping pace with the growth in health care costs.
That's going to happen under any scenario in the future, because the status quo is unsustainable. Right now, Medicare has a $38 trillion unfunded liability. And if government actually tried to pay all of that, the tax increases, the borrowing that would occur would bankrupt our country, kill our economy. So under any scenario going forward, you will not have the kind of Medicare spending in 20, 30, 40 years that is being projected right now. So I'm basically saying, let's go with what works. And what works pretty well is the plan I've got in Congress and federal employees have. But more to the point is I do other reforms to the healthcare system itself to try and go at the root cause of health inflation. So let's not just accept that healthcare costs are always going to go up at 8% a year forever, and we just have to accept that. No, I don't accept that. Let's bring down healthcare costs so that those dollars we give seniors stretch a lot further so that they do get comprehensive health care. The alternative to this path that I've provided here is basically the government has to become a big healthcare monopoly, and then it will have to ration through bureaucratic formulas, which deny people the kind of customized care that they and their physicians expect they are going to get.
You know, President Obama has talked about the political vulnerability of doing anything that tinkers with Medicare. And I wonder, wouldn't voters back home in Wisconsin there be looking at this and saying, you're trying to cut my benefits, you're trying to privatize my care, I don't trust these health insurance companies?
I introduced this bill 2 years ago. I ran for re-election on it in the last election cycle. I'm very clear with the people who hired me as to what I'm proposing. They understand this. Number one, I am saying no changes for people above the age of 55. Number two, I'm saying let's convert the system now so that people can plan for it. That's compassionate, that works, that's sustainable. I would argue that it's really not a privatization any more than the federal employee health benefit plan that federal workers and members of Congress have is a privatized system. So I simply am saying let's go with common sense ideas that work, that have proven over time to actually do the job that we're trying to do. And that, to me, is what I think the people who hired me want me to do. Look, I don't think people sent me to Washington from southern Wisconsin to just be a part of the problem, to point fingers, to just jump on the partisan bandwagon. I think they sent me there to try and solve problems, to put ideas on the table, to get ourselves out of the debt and the deficit and the fiscal crisis we're approaching. And that's exactly what I'm trying to do.
Congressman Ryan, thanks for being with us.
You bet. Nice to be with you.
That's Congressman Paul Ryan, Republican of Wisconsin. He's ranking member of the House Budget Committee.